listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. What do Luis Rodriguez and Father Gregory Boyle have in common? Well, a lot. First and foremost, they're both peacemakers. They're both award-winning writers, though Father Greg's prize-winning book, Tattoos on the Heart, doesn't yet have the distinction of being named by the American Library Association as one of the nation's 100 most censored books, which Luis's memoir, Always Running, La Vida Loca, does. Both men have, through different paths, devoted their lives to social justice, to finding the light through the shadows, to creating what Martin Luther King Jr. called the beloved community. So how wonderful to have them here the day after, the day in which we honor Dr. Martin Luther King. Luis J. Rodriguez, the son of Mexican immigrants, began writing in his early teens and has won national recognition as a poet, journalist, fiction writer, children's book writer, and critic, and mentor. Luis co-founded Tia Chucha Press and Tia Chucha's Centro Cultural and Bookstore, a cultural center in the North San Fernando Valley, and he's currently working as a peacemaker among gangs on a national and international level. He'll be in conversation tonight with Father Gregory Boyle, a Jesuit priest who founded Homeboy Industries in 1988. And I hope everyone here has eaten at Homegirl Cafe. And if you haven't, you haven't lived, so go have some great food. Since Father Greg started Homeboy, it's estimated it has served members of more than half of the gangs in Los Angeles. Father Greg is the recipient of numerous awards, including the California Peace Prize, the Irving Leadership Award, and an honorary doctorate of humane letters from Occidental College. And his memoir, Tattoos on the Heart, has been honored by Penn USA as the 2011 Best Creative Nonfiction Book of the Year. Tonight's conversation between Luis and Father Greg is on the occasion of Luis's most recent book, It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing, which tells a story of what it takes to leave a gang, what it means to start over, and how the past, crimes, drugs, what you've seen and done, has a way of calling you back. We'll begin with a reading by Luis, followed...
Thank you very much. I'm going to read a little bit from the book, It Calls You Back. And I thought that I would concentrate on the situation with my son, Ramiro. And I'm going to start on the day he was born. I watched the baby being born as if in a trance. He came out reddish purple with a milky substance all over. He was tiny. I could carry him in one hand. He had a huge bald head and a large tummy. He turned out to be underweight, less than 5 pounds. This was the problem. They had him in an incubator. I provided Camila, who was my first wife, encouraging words about how this was okay, it was normal, he'd be fine. But inside, I worried. For a couple days, while Camila rested, they kept him under close watch. He had a hard time latching on to the nipple, but he finally did. Things looked better. When we left the hospital, our baby came home as well. We named him Ramiro Daniel. It was June 1975. Ramiro slept so much. One night, with Camila resting, I held him. He had been out for hours. I wonder now if he had symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome, but there was no way to know at the time. As I gazed upon Ramiro, I began to cry. I'm not entirely sure why. It was a mixture of happiness and concern. The boy looked stern, even with closed eyelids, and he had hardly any hair on his head, like an old man. For a few minutes, I thought Ramiro wouldn't wake up. I put the infant next to my face, and tears streamed down. Even though I had no God to appeal to, I prayed, "Save my son. You can do anything to me, but save Ramiro. He deserves a better life than I ever had. He deserves to be something. As some of you know, 2.5 years later, I abandoned my son. And this is what happens when it calls you back. I tried to be a father to him when he was 13 years old. And as some of you know the story, it didn't quite work out. He joined a gang at 15. By the time he was 17, he was facing his first prison sentence. But I'm going to read a section here that's really the hardest, one of the hardest ones. Just as me and my son were just, I had it up to here with him. You know what I'm talking about. But it really was up, I had it up to here with me. I didn't know that it was me. And so I'm going to read you this one section, and then we'll sit down. The night was warm. I prepared myself to bed. My thoughts were on Ramiro and the myriad of problems he kept getting into. I also worried about Ruben and Luis, my other boys, still growing. I considered as well the back and forth dealings with my daughter Andrea, her baby, and concerns around her boyfriend. And I went round and round in my head about other grandkids from different mothers, each with their own uncertainties. I loved them all. These were my family. But that night, all this seemed to collapse around me. Family, writing, working with the young people, most of whom did well, more than a few were in deep trouble. For income, I hustled. I was now self-employed, speaking, reading, and writing. Over time, this worked out well, but in the early years, it was a strain. Anyway, that night, I'm sorry, just before that, me and my wife were organizing, my wife Trini was organizing my public events, which were becoming more frequent. But we still managed to get into shouting matches. I learned how difficult I could be for Trini as a business partner. Much of this irritability, again, was linked to my newfound sobriety. That night, I lay down in the second floor bedroom, unable to sleep. I had insomnia for a long time, mulling over work and home predicaments, as well as how to make ends meet. Later, as I dozed off, I heard Ramiro and the mother of his oldest daughter shouting. I got terribly annoyed. They were outside, just below my window. I got up, put on my pants and shirt, and stormed down the stairs. I confronted Ramiro. I heard him curse me out. That's when I lost it. The thing was, he didn't say this to me. He was still arguing with the mother of his child, but I didn't get that part. Everything in front of me turned red. My head erupted in lights. I couldn't see straight. I rushed up to the bedroom. Trini was there, nervous, confused, not knowing what to do. I wanted her to stop me, but she couldn't. It wasn't her fault. She knew how I could get. And she had no strategies, no way to soothe the monster I'd become. I rushed back down 2 more flights to the basement bedroom where Ramiro had gone after my initial outbursts. I got into my son's face, pushed him. I called him out. Ramiro tried to reason with me, to calm me down, but he also had difficulties with rage. Soon, we were both yelling. I dared Ramiro to fight me. I wanted an excuse to kick his butt. Ramiro wasn't much of a fighter. Eventually, he would be, especially behind bars. We took our arguing further into the basement, away from his room. Trini was behind me trying to get me back upstairs. Ramiro's baby mama was trying to talk him into walking away. His daughter, not even 3 years old, looked scared. I blocked all this out, locked inside a frenzied state. Then Ramiro picked up a hitch trimmer from the garden tools in the basement. He threatened me with it. "Go ahead, use it," I said, provoking him. Ramiro came at me. I moved part of the hedge trimmer, scraping the side of my big belly, drawing a little blood. But I also sensed something else. My son was trying hard not to hurt me. I'd have known he was going at me with all his strength. He wasn't. Ramiro just wanted to keep me off him. That's when I realized what a stupid I was. At this point, my granddaughter's mother, who was small in stature and relatively thin, tackled Ramiro. I saw her fly at him from another section of the basement. They both landed on boxes and plastic bags filled with clothing, the hedge trimmer falling to the ground. Aware now that Ramiro was making sure I didn't get hurt, seeing his daughter distressed and then her mother risking herself to pull my son away, I stopped. I had no more words, no more rage, no more energy. I walked away and back up the stairs, pushing past Trini, who looked hurt and unsure. The last thing I recall was Ramiro cursing me out as he left with his child and the kid's mother, taking a few items, threatening never to return.
Thank you, Louis. I'm sort of the Charlie Rose of this evening, so you and I both know that, like with homies, you know, there's a kind of a hole in the heart of every homie that's sort of in the shape of their own father. You have a thing here about your own father where you say, all my life I wanted another father. How do you make sense of that, and how would you guide the healing that ought to happen between a father and a son?
Well, I think fathers are one of these things that you don't have no choice in. And you got to recognize that there's things you do have choices in, which I think are more like destiny. Destiny, people think it happens no matter what, but really you have to choose to go that way. It's kind of like a destination that you can go on, but you have to make that decision. Fate or things like a father is where the cards fall. You don't make a choice there. So this father that I had wasn't a father I would have chose, but it was my father, the only one I had. Yeah. The only one that you can, you know, say, well, I'm from him. And as much as I might hate him, whatever, you still love him. And that's part of the story. As you know, in the book, my dad did some very terrible things. And I hated him for it. And I also couldn't stop loving him. And that's the hard part about fathers and mothers. Even when they abuse you, even when they hurt you, even when they do things, they really are the ones that you supposedly trust and love. And that's why it hurts. They're not the monsters that are in the corner. You know, so, yeah, that happens. But these are people who you know. Yeah. And that's why it makes it hard to reconcile yourself with the father that you were given. But a part of you has to, at a certain point, say, he's my dad, the only dad I have.
Yeah. And then you split hairs even. You say, at least he was a dad who came home and you had all these friends who didn't. Little images, like he taught you chess.
I had to bring in those things, because here's the thing. When you're writing a memoir, I don't really want to disparage anybody.
Yeah.
I have to tell the truth. But it's not really my purpose. I'm out to get people. It just isn't. And all the people that I talked about, that even hurt people, it's not my purpose. I'm out to get them. It's more, I got to tell this truth. And when I'm going to talk about my dad, I have to bring in that, you know, he was also a hardworking person. He did work hard, hours and hours, didn't come home till late at night. He gave me books when nobody else did. Books became my life.
Right.
I have to give, there's a destiny fate thing that came together with him, with books. I have to say that, you know, he was a nice person to everybody in the world. What he did that was terrible, I can't leave him off the hook for.
Right.
You know, I can't condone that. On the other hand, I have to say, but he wasn't just this scarred out monster. He really was probably a human being caught up in some circumstances I don't know about, and this is the way it turned out for him.
Yeah. You know, this is a beautiful book. I recommend it if any of you have not yet had a chance to read it. We were commenting about how we're the same age, and I'll tell you something that was foreign to me in this book was the whole manufacturing thing, like Bethlehem Steel. Like, that is such a disappeared reality now. What do you, and the fact that you talk about your father being a hard worker, you know, you really, con ganas, you used to work in these places with a work ethic that, you know, like, it's hard to come by. But what do you make sense of the fact that this has so disappeared from the landscape here and probably never to return in any significant way?
Well, the way I look at it, it kind of links up to the work we do with these gang kids. When I was getting out of a gang and heroin addiction and everything, I had one place you can go. It was not the best place, but it was a job. It really, you could get a job.
Yeah.
L.A. is the largest manufacturing center in the country. That's why there were so many Mexicanos and people from the South and people from all over the country coming there. You know, it was huge with just working class people. And Bethlehem Steel and, you know, the General Motors plants and aerospace, the shipyards, it was huge. So I'm a batito. I'm getting out of the jails. I'm getting out of the drugs. Where do I go? I have to go and work. It was good. The generation that we're working with kids, they didn't have that.
Right.
In the 80s, it all left. And not just in LA, of course, the whole Rust Belt, Chicago. I spent 15 years in Chicago. Huge industrial town. Those jobs are gone. And when you think about the biggest rise in gangs in the U.S. in the 80s, It was LA and Chicago, right. The two big industrial places. And of course, Detroit is included in Gary, Indiana, you know, all that area. So, you know, well, that contributes to what we're talking about. Kids don't have an outlet of just having work in their hands. Yeah. And I think that impacted tremendously, negatively, these neighborhoods that we're working in.
Yeah. You know, trying to make sense of the gang reality, which is the thing that sort of connects our lives together, and you've long been a hero of mine. And in the best book ever written about gangs, to my thinking, is Always Running. I always say this to people. You mentioned when you were in your reporter days about a kid named Osvaldo. I don't know if that was his real name. Maybe you had
to change it.
Yeah. But you write here, he looked like I used to look, with a cold demeanor and nonchalant attitude. I understood all this, including why he couldn't show remorse, from a developmental inability, but also from whatever he'd done to cut off parts of his humanity to survive. He had a terrible home life of painful abuse and poverty, surrounded by limitations at every turn. When you mention these kinds of issues, people say they are excuses. So how do you address that? What folks, gang members, kids in the communities that we know have to carry so much?
Well, I think it's like looking at the whole thing, because we always tend to look at it very fractured. Most of our lives are fractured, so we don't know how to see beyond it. So my whole thing is look at the whole thing. There's a reason. I believe, even though it seems senseless, the violence in the streets, I really think it all makes sense. You just got to go deep in the roots. You'll find the root for all of it. It may not seem like sensical when a kid is just going drive by and shooting somebody he doesn't know. That looks bad and it's not good. But if you go to the roots, you'll find out what he went through, what happened in his life, his fears, because a lot of this is driven by fear, not, you know, I'm the toughest guy in the world. More like I'm a scared guy, and I don't know what to do. So you go. I think that's what I'm asking for people, not to look at excuses for why people do, but look at the roots of them, because you're not gonna get deeper into anything unless you look at the roots, which are personal, but also political, social, economic. The roots are varied, so you get a whole picture. So you really understand why these kids are doing what they're doing, instead of what people think it is. They're just bad kids. Bad parents, they're all messed up, forget them. You look at the roots, and some of it, unfortunately, some of those roots come and get you, that you're actually participating right. in making that reality.
The other night I spoke with a whole bunch of very wealthy people, and afterwards somebody came up and said, you know, we need to get these kids when they're young. We always hear this. Mm-hmm. And then the guy said, because how else are they going to learn the difference between right and wrong? And a line I've incorporated from you, I don't know where I got it, where I stole it from. I think from an op-ed piece you wrote, where you talk about a high moral distance between us and them. And so if it's about, I found myself telling this guy, yeah, you know, if it's about morality, then how I wish it were, because it would be so simple.
Yeah.
But we want to strike this high moral distance because it's the thing that separates us. Yeah. It's the thing that says my kids aren't as bad as the kids that engage in the stuff that we're familiar with. Right. But in the end, how do we get a compassion that can stand in awe at what folks have to carry? You read this book and you get a sense of what folks have to carry who live in another part of the city, and you move away from a judgment that condemns how they've sort of managed their lives.
Well, I think that's important, because judging is a distancing. And I'm not saying there's not a place for it, but I think it's very important that whatever we do, not disconnect. I don't care where you live, what neighborhood you live. If you disconnect, then you're in danger of for yourself, but also in danger of agreeing to policies that totally don't work. Like, somebody has to agree that we need more prisons in this country, because why are there so many prisons? Whether you like it or not, there's people that are agreeing with this, who don't understand how the prisons have made things worse, not better, have contributed to even more violence. Somebody has to agree that we need to go to war every time somebody does something to us. Somebody has to do that, because we're constantly doing it. So we distance ourselves, and therefore we let things happen, and we don't think it has anything to do with us. I really do feel that a lot of these kids do know what's right and wrong. They do have a morality. Many of them grew up Catholicos or in the church, or they had mothers and fathers. A lot of their mother fathers were good parents, and they still lost their kids. In the Always Running book, you see that guy with a tattoo, and you see he's got the Virgen de Guadalupe, And underneath it, he says, perdóname, madrecita, for my crazy life. He knows what he's doing. But what people don't understand is what kind of world and circumstances will get a kid like this who knows that, you know, he loves God, he loves his mother, he loves the Virgen, but he got, now he's caught in la vida loca and he can't help to do what that demands of him, even if he has to kill somebody. That's what you have to understand. How does somebody get from those households and those churches to be in a circumstance where I have to kill somebody? That's what I'm caught in. I'm caught in this web and I can't let it go.
Well, what's your diagnosis? Like, you know, people ask me all this all the time, and I'm sure they ask you, what's your succinct when somebody says, why does a kid join a gang?
Well, there's many factors, as you know, and I think about what mine were. I think about it, I was 11 years old, so I couldn't have been mature. But at 11 years old, what was I looking for? I was a beaten down, shy kid who couldn't speak the language. I was silent inside, silent outside. Schools weren't there for me. I always felt that every time I went to school, my dignity was constantly on the line. Every time I went to school. My parents were just frustrated and confused. I was a broken down, shy kid. And here's what happened. A local gang broke into the elementary school to go after some people. I thought this was the greatest thing I ever saw in my life. They were like tough. They weren't scared of teachers. They weren't scared of anybody. They broke through the school. People were screaming and yelling. And you know what? My brokenness was such that I want that power. Whatever they got, I want it. You know, I want this power to hurt people, to scare people. You know what I'm saying? That's what happens when you're broken down, that you start looking at stuff like this. You see these cholos, and they were like different and cool. And I'm like, I want this. Well, 11 years old, of course I'm not thinking right. But the point is, what brings an 11-year-old to that place? Thinking that this means power, this is respect. So in my case, I wasn't drafted into the gang. I wasn't forced in the gang. I was so attracted to this because I was missing something so much in myself. I thought that's what I wanted more than anything.
But don't you think that sometimes, you know, it's push-pull. You know, how much is push, how much is pull? You know, how much is lure and how much is fleeing? You know, because I think in almost, you know, I don't think we've ever met a hopeful kid that joined a gang. Right. So whatever reason that led that kid to be stuck in a place of despair that's sort of lethal, how do you, because I think that's essential. Because if we think it's just about lure and attraction, then we're going to deal with this idea that it's rational and that it's rationally attractive. As opposed to a kid isn't seeking something, maybe he's fleeing something. Not sort of...
It works both ways. But here's the other thing. I went to these well-off schools one time in Pennsylvania, the main line. Best. I don't know if you guys know the main line in Pennsylvania. It's like one of the richest communities ever. They had 5 private schools. They invited me to speak for a multicultural week. You know, I was their multicultural guest. But, you know, I learned something there. These kids, parents were paying $20,000 a year. They had the best everything. Do you think those kids weren't broken? That they weren't lost and confused? They were in pretty bad shape. Some of them were suicidal. They were on drugs. Mm-hmm. But I was that way. I had nowhere to look. There was no Little League. There was no organization. There was nothing. There wasn't even really, the church was so small. You know, it really wasn't even the place to go. The gang became the place. Now these kids, they're broken down, they're shy, they're whatever they're going through, but they had a whole different reality surrounding them. No matter what, they were going to succeed, no matter what. In my community, we were going to fail no matter when we wanted to succeed. We were going to fail. Yeah. So you had a combination of all this push-pull, whatever eternity is going on, with a world that also at the same time is kind of like a vertex, pulling you down even when you don't want to. And sure, there's a lot of us in the body that make it, you know, that survive. But, you know, it's that vortex is constantly pulling you down. Mm-hmm. Whereas in these other communities, kids are going down, but there's a vortex going up. You know?
Switching gears a little bit, because there's so much in this odyssey, and we've known each other a long time, but the reporter period in your life was something that was kind of new to me. Mm. And... You know, Did you have like a reflection as a reporter, like how you would cover gangs for the LA Times, or what's missing in since you had that experience? I mean, it was sort of limited, you know, in one sense, but it also even the stuff you were doing in Nicaragua and like what would
well, I think
be
what
something
happened
that you would...
is I was more interested in the politics of things because I got very highly politicized in my youth that got me thinking about the world. So I was really more of a journalist in the sense of how can I bring the truth of what the gang kids go through to the world. It was more like I felt like I had to bring in that reality of the body of the working class, the poor. How can I voice it? That was really my concern. Going to Nicaragua and Honduras also helped me. These are poor people being suffering. A lot of it through policies that our government was responsible for. So I wanted to voice and tell the story. But I found a number of things. First of all, it may have changed a little bit, but in those days, if you were a brown Mexican reporter, you weren't given the same voice as even the white reporters. Even though I was working there, I noticed this. I also noticed that when I went to the neighborhoods to try to cover stories of not just the violent, every time that a Mexican or black person showed up in the newspapers because of somebody getting killed, I wanted to tell the story about kids trying to save their lives, of really good programs and parents and stuff. That wasn't really wanted. I tried, they didn't want it. I found myself battling that battle still of being the voice and then not being to be heard. When I was in southern Honduras and we were finding out about the Contras, nobody gave me the credentials to say, you're a legitimate reporter. They wouldn't, Luis Rodriguez, you have to be a bias. They weren't saying this. Right. You know what they think? Oh, you have to be biased. Somebody else would, from with another land name, you know, another community could do it and be given the credence. I had to fight harder to just to be given that credence that I was a reporter and I could be legitimate. It was a battle that I found that I couldn't really continue fighting it. That's why I quit all those jobs. But the point was, I find it very hard to have even that voice. Now I speak better as an outside, not within journalism, talk about these kids. I speak better now from where I'm doing it now. I'm on my own. I work for myself, you know, and I have all these articles and new magazines and, you know, books. Now I'm being able to do it. But if I worked in an institution, my voice would have been more silent, I think, than it is now.
Tell the story about the, you know, tell our side of the story with the reporter who was from the radio. You know, where he wasn't recording and...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, that story, and then also, what is the side of the story that doesn't get heard?
Well, for example, there was a kid that were getting killed, and I was young. I wasn't a reporter yet. I was still like a little vato, a little hanging out guy. And I went to the funeral, and there was a reporter there.
That's right.
And I was interested, you know, dude, tell our side of the story, you know. Because, you know, whatever he was doing, I thought it was an opportunity. I could tell he was being annoyed, but I kept at it. And eventually what happens, other kids came up, and they were like, hey, yeah, tell our side. They all wanted to be heard. So the guy says, okay. He put his mic out, and we were all talking. And it was really beautiful stuff. It wasn't about, gangsters, we're going to kill these guys. It was more about the issues and the pain, you know. It was very beautiful. And then I noticed that the guy didn't have his recorder on. Now, it could have been like he'd forgotten, but I knew he hadn't forgotten. We weren't going to be heard. He was just kind of like, I'll play with these guys, and I'll pretend I'm co-recording them. But those voices couldn't be heard. Even then. And it was one of those things that made me think I needed to be that voice then. I had to be one of those guys to could really tell these stories because I wasn't going to be dependent on somebody else trying to get it.
You know, yesterday we celebrated Martin Luther King, and about 2 years before he died, you know, he kind of expanded the focus of his efforts to beyond political and civil rights to include economic justice. And, you know, the economic inequality is not a defect in the system. It is the system.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you started to write about that and to work in that in the organizing effort. Say something about what was sort of the vision that you, in all the organizing efforts, especially in Chicago probably principally, but every place else too.
I think we were.
Where do we need to be?
I think we're entering. We're in a precipice of something new, and the old ways of doing things are just not working. This is we're all aware of it. I think this is why we're at the point where voices and things that never could be heard, now they're being heard, like Occupy movement. People are hearing things they never could hear before. Now we can talk about the 99% versus the 1%. That was almost unheard of.
Yeah, I
would talk about it and yeah. Now everybody's like, wait a minute, there's something there. I think we're in the precipice of something new, and it isn't going to be the same old economic basis. It's not going to be the same old economic system. Now I think it's what we can imagine and what we can put forward with the most. You talk about this, the most caring, compassionate heart. Because to me, this is what we're at. If our heart and humanity doesn't play a role in this time, we're going to lose it again. We're going to fall to some practical things. We're going to keep doing the same old thing. But the heart wants something different. It wants something else. It's kind of like, where's the fullness of our lives going to be felt and heard and finally lived out? That's what people are crying for. When you look at a gang kid, that's what they're crying for. When you look at a kid who's rich in a gated community, that's what he's crying for. Where is the fullness of our lives? Where are we going to be those complete human beings that we're meant to be? And that's the kind of society that we're going to go towards, or we're not going to make it. We have to now imagine our way through this now. It isn't going to be a simple thing. But one of the things is obvious, as you say, the system can't be fixed. It's not a fixable system. But what's going to lead you? If it's just going to be your mind and your practical things, we're going to fail. It's got to be that, with as much thinking as you got, but it's got to be your heart too. It's got to come together so that we can encompass everybody and not just a few.
Mm-hmm. The part of what you engaged in, certainly in Chicago and across the nation, and has been peacemaking. That was part of Louise's kind introduction. But at Homeboy Industries, I always say, we don't work with gangs, we work with gang members. Mm-hmm. And we've discussed this before. But I always think of, I think peacemaking requires conflict. And I think that in gang violence, there is no conflict. I think there's violence, but there isn't any conflict, which is to say it isn't about anything. Mm. So my experience is that homies who go on missions, who go on forays into enemy territory, everyone I know is not hoping to kill. They're kind of hoping to die.
Yeah.
And that in the end, I wonder about the effort to try to bring sides together as if it's Northern Ireland or the Middle East. Yeah. Because in the end, no gang I know of can you sit down and say, okay, what are your demands? What are the things that you want from each other? You know,
yeah.
I want to practice my religion freely. I'd like my homeland back.
Right.
It's not about that.
Yeah.
And so part of me feels like... We need to get the diagnosis right. And if we think gang violence is about conflict, then we're going to walk towards conflict resolution. Yeah. But I don't think it is. That I think it's about something else. It's a language unto itself that is unlike the kinds of things that we try to see as a parallel. So take me on that one.
Well, here's what I would say. When you don't have much to work with, you're still trying to find meaning out of it. You know what I'm saying? And I think gang kids are like anybody else. They're going to find, okay, I got to go back to why I put so much meaning behind my barrio. It was the only thing I could hang on to. I had no culture. I had no roots. My roots in Mexico, I didn't know. My parents couldn't relate. I had nowhere to go. White people, forget it. That was another world. You know what I'm saying? I had nowhere to go. The gang, the barrio became my place where I could feel some sense of rootedness, connection, meaning. But unfortunately, when you identify with that, you have to identify with all of it, which includes, we got to fight this other barrio. Okay, I'm doing that. And then I got to be the harder guy. I'm got to be the guy that's doing it more than anybody because I want to be one step ahead of everybody. Or let's go get these guys. And then I'll find myself totally identified with my trauma, my emptiness, and my brokenness. I'm identifying with every bad thing. And now I can't let it go. Because I'm so identified with it, I can't separate myself. So the work that I do, people call it gang intervention. I don't care what you call it. It really is the work towards the humanness of why we do what we do and why we are who we are. For example, I don't have an anti-gang program, as you know. I have a beautiful cultural center. It's all arts. I work through the arts. I have all kinds of people come in, and then I have these vatos with tattoos on themselves, and they're walking in there. I don't judge them any different than the guys that don't have the tattoos. But I know why they're coming in, and I go, you want to do art? That's what we're going to do. And the art changes them. You know what I'm saying? In the community where all of a sudden there's people paying attention to them, seeing them beyond the tattoos, you know what I'm saying? Seeing them beyond that hardness that they keep thinking is their identity. Seeing them for different. Then they begin to open up. I find that a lot of it's just seeing them again deeper than what they're even willing to put out there. So it really isn't about the conflict I'm going to get. But I'm going to tell you something that I think it does eventually lead to. I hooked up with an enemy of mine. My body have been fighting this other neighborhood since the late 40s, early 50s. In the 60s, it went crazy. I was there when it went crazy. Sangre and Lomas, they were going at it. They're still going at it. They're still killing each other. This guy, he's now a famous tattoo artist. He was from Sangre. I hooked up with him recently. His son was killed by my homeboys, not my particular homeboys, but from my gang. I went to give him my condolences, you know, and we talked. I just found out in our talking that he actually shot at me. The many myriad drive-bys that went by, he was in a car. We recounted this incident where he was in a car where one of my homeboys was actually shot, and he was shooting at me. He was one of those guys shooting at me. I didn't get hit, but he was the guy shooting at me. Now, here we are. We didn't talk about, you know, conflict resolution. We just talked about now we're two artists, two human beings, you know, and we found each other. You know what I'm saying? We found ourselves just through the art. He does it as a tattoo artist because that's all he knows, you know, but he's really good at it. I'm doing it as a writer, you know, because I think I'm pretty good at it a little bit maybe. But, you know, the point is, that's how we came together. You see what I'm saying? So it wasn't about I'm going to get my body or your body. We're going to sit down and we're going to find peace. It was more the peace came by doing these other things that we really love that was in us. And the more that I can help draw that out of people, all these gang kids, other kids, the more just draw it out of what's already inside of them. And then they find these places to combine. That body of stuff, no matter how hard it was, begins to not be as hard. I'm telling you, me and him were having dinner talking about how he shot at me. And then I talked about, unfortunately, I had to confess my end of it. I firebombed his best homie's house. We were talking all this terrible stuff, but now here we are, 40 years later, looking at each other. Because now we're not enemies, you know what I'm saying? Now that's over with. We are now brothers in the arts. Brothers and whatever it is that puts us together.
But part of what you're describing is the task, I think, which is to re-identify. So you began by saying your identity is all wrapped up in Lomas. Right. And that's not to say you deny where you've been.
Right.
But I think like at Homeboy Industries, that's the real deal is when somebody can... It's almost the difference between sobriety and recovery.
Yeah.
Like somebody who's a dry drunk but doesn't have any insight about... Yeah. What this is about, and you know the difference. Yeah. The same thing happens like with a gang member. You want them to get to a place, you've gotten to a place where your part of your identity is father, writer, mm-hmm. poet, husband. Yeah. These things are, that's where you want to be.
Yeah.
And it's tough for homies at our place because they begin and then they gain a certain kind of resilience. But the real task is to be able to go out into the world as a re-identified person, without denying stuff that's happened, but say, now I know what that was about, and I'm more father and husband than I am homie, I guess.
Yeah.
Does that make sense in terms of the parallel like with your own recovery?
The problem is that a lot of people don't have good relationships with their fathers or mothers, so they don't see what the difference is. I'm still got drama at home. You know, I had these guys tell me, you know, I got married. I got the wife. Man, it's worse. I'd rather be in the street, you know. wait, dude, I know. I get it. So it's better that they're in the home and trying to deal with it than they're in the street. And it's kind of like, okay, you're never going to be in a place where you're going to be totally peaceful where nothing happens. But at least you're choosing the battles and the conflicts that are worth something. The struggle to be a father is painful. It's hard, but that's the one you have to be in.
Right.
Versus, I'm going to be the toughest vato in the neighborhood. Okay, dude, come on. Fight. It's going to be hard. is not going to be easy. Being sober is one of the hardest things I ever did. It was the hardest, most painful thing. I had a hard time with it. I became more uglier inside being sober than when I wasn't. I became more raging. I was like, wow, who needs this, you know? But I needed it. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. I had to be in that place better than the other place. Because sometimes what you identify with is so unhealthy, but it sometimes feels like this is so much you. The comfort in being in those messed up places is hard to break from. So being in that uncomfortable place where I got to be a father, I got to be somebody that's going to help somebody. Being in those uncomfortable places of being in the street talking to kids, you know what I mean, and trying to change their lives, it's very uncomfortable. Having kids call you out, you know, I don't like that. Hey, in the old days, I wouldn't even take it, you know. Now I'm having to take it, man, and sit there with them. But it's better there. You know, I mean, eventually some part of me has to say, it's better to be in this struggle, in this battle, than to be in the one I was in. I keep reminding myself, you know, when I was a kid, I would fight for anything. Somebody gave me a dirty look, stepped on my shoe. I'd be willing to kill and die for that. Well, now if I'm going to die for something, which I'm going to die anyway, I might as well die for something that's really big and beautiful and worthwhile, even if it's just saving some kids. So I don't mind. People say, aren't you worried some kid, you're going to get shot by some stray bullet? Well, when I was a kid, I wanted to get shot. I'm not trying to get shot. I'm not hanging to get shot, but if I get shot by a stray bullet trying to bring peace, to me, that's worth it. You see what I'm saying? Right, it's like, that's okay. If I'm going to do it, I'm not looking for that, but I'd rather do it there than when I used to be, when I would want to get shot no matter, you know, whatever's going on. So it is a matter of knowing how to open a new door that's not going to be away from pain and suffering, but it's going to be the kind of elegant, beautiful anguish that somebody has to go through to find their life.
Yeah. Something we talked about earlier, and maybe I'll end this question and before we open it up to the audience here, is your own spiritual journey. You know, we talked about God for a second there in the green room. So,
and not just because he's Father Gregory. I know that might seem like it, but I'm sure he gets us all the time.
Yeah. So, like, you know, you go out of your way to say you're an atheist.
Yeah, I was an atheist. It's a very important part of my life. I think I could have said, I don't want to talk about that. Who cares?
Yeah.
It was a very important part of my life. In many ways, being an atheist helped me find myself because I couldn't fall into the churches. The churches were not helpful to me.
Yeah.
But I did learn after many, many years of being an atheist that I was missing a very important part of who I was. The spiritual part, I guess. The part that actually connected to a creator spirit somehow. And I found that I couldn't get sober entirely without connecting to that. I just couldn't do it. I thought that I could. You know, I'm smart. I can do it. I really couldn't. And I'm not saying this to anybody. I'm not trying to proselytize or convince anybody. People have to go through their own journeys. But mine eventually had to bring me back to what I was missing. And that was a spiritual connection. I had to find God in my own way. Not through church, because I don't do it through church. But I had to go back. Now, in many ways, I did it through my own indigenous roots. I did it through the Native American traditions. I did it through the Native Mexican Native traditions. That's how I found it. That's what I do now. I now have a spiritual sweat lodge circle that we do in San Fernando, which is open to anybody. It's not a belief system because we don't care what you believe in. I've had Buddhists in there. I've had, you know, Christians. And, you know, I even had atheists. I don't believe in nothing. Go on, come on in. You know? It doesn't matter to me. But I think what I did find is that personally, I had to find that God spirit that I feel connected me to everybody. That part of me that wasn't just the lonely soul in the world, which I am, but also that part of me that connects to every lonely soul, you know what I'm saying? Which eventually becomes the spirit that we all hang on to. So it really isn't a battle. You got to believe the way I believe. It's more of I need to connect with the world and something beyond the world. And that was important for me.
Was there anything in your family that did your family have a kind of a belief system that you had to reject? Or
I had to reject the Catholicism. And I hate to say that to Father Greg, but I had to do that.
No,
I had to
reject. No, I battle.
Yeah, no. It's like my friend Michael Mead says, you know, he's a recovering Catholic, you know, so I had to go through that. But you know what? All this did was bring me back to the Catholics. Brought me back to working with evangelicals. My whole family's evangelical Christians. They're beautiful people. I got no issue with them. I might have issues with them in other things, but basically they're fine. They found their place.
Sure.
So I think it brought me back to all those things, but now I look at it differently. Not judgmental, not I'm better than them, not above them or below them. You know what I'm saying? Now I'm like, hey, man, we're in the same boat. You know, whatever you believe in, this is a big, huge Titanic, and we're all going to fall down. And some of your belief is going to keep you from losing it as you're going over. But some of the belief is going to get you strong and keep you trying to do whatever you can to say what was beautiful and worth saving in that sinking ship.
Yeah.
So that's part of like where I'm at, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's open it up to folks here. I know that Louise has a microphone somewhere out there.
Thank you both for being here and for being who you are. I would like you both, please, to talk about the factors that you know that would bring a teenager out of the gang life in the street. What are the factors, and I'm sure there are many, that allow for someone to move from that life to another one?
Well, I can bring in what I think. I have five that I try to work with. There's probably 500, but let's just work with five. Every kid has different needs, but these are the five I found to be important. One, get them rooted somehow. There's different ways of doing it, but most of these kids feel uprooted. Their spirit is uprooted, whether they know it or not. They may be hanging on to a barrio, you know, but they're uprooted. They really don't have deep roots. The barrio's roots are very small when you think about it, but they put so much behind it. So they need to get rooted again. And rooted could be in family, in their traditions and cultures, whatever it may be. That's one thing. The second thing is I tell them you got to find a community, even if it's temporary, that's healthy, that's going to help you. Because, you know, they have all these communities and they're unhealthy. You know, even their own families are unhealthy. Right. They got to find a community that says, even if it's temporary, we're going to take you on a healthy way here. We're going to give you knowledge and awareness. They need something. They need help. That's why I say get help. A lot of these guys are knuckleheads like I was, wouldn't get help from nobody. No, get help. Three, I tell them to find their art. Because to me, that's one of the things that really connects. Everybody's an artist at some level. You know, even if being a mechanic, I had these kids tell me, well, I'm not an artist, I want to be a mechanic. Well, don't you got to be an artist to be a mechanic? There's an art in it. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, good. So I get them going in that direction. The next thing I tell them is to find a cause, because I think that this connection is very deep. A cause bigger than themselves. And what is that? That could be even being a good father is a great cause. Isn't that a great cause? That's an important cause. But it could even be like, I want to help the community. I want to change this. I want to bring peace. I want to, whatever, be a teacher, change kids' lives, have a cause. The other thing I tell them is to get a spiritual life. And I don't want to impose it because I think they're all valid. If it speaks to them, they're all valid. Help them find what they think will really connect to them. But don't lose out on that spiritual part of who they are. And then the very last thing I tell them is because the web of La Vida Loca holds you so deep, and you're not owning your life. I tell them, all of this is so you can own your life. Own it. This is yours. When you're in that web, you don't own it. Whether it's the web of heroin or crystal meth or alcohol, something else owns you, right? If it's the gang, eventually the body is owning you. You know, the prison life, it starts owning you. And it starts owning your mind and what you do, what you don't do. So I tell them, you got to own it. You got to make sure it's all yours.
I think that, you know, this is about a lethal absence of hope. So the pilot light of hope is so flickering, you know, and that it's about somehow we have to infuse a sense of hope to kids for whom hope is foreign. So the only delivery system I know for that is really loving, caring adults who pay attention. So you just have to show up. But it's a like recovery, you know, because no amount of me wanting that kid to have a life is the same as that kid wanting to have one. So in recovery, they always say it takes what it takes. You know, it can be the birth of a son or the death of a friend or a long stretch in prison. Whatever it is, it takes what it takes. But as long as, and I agree with Louis, of course, that, you know, community trumps gang. So you have to have that around. And it's interesting that, you know, to hear about a healthy community, if there's a really kind of an absence of community or a few places for that kid to gravitate when he or she's ready, that's problematic. But those are the things, you know, a place that will hold the kid with a kind of no matter whatness and unconditionally.
First of all, thank you very much for doing this. It's a great privilege to be able to hear someone who's lived such a life. But what would you say that people like myself, who are part of society that haven't necessarily been a part of gang life but have lived around it, had family members, etc., what can we do to, going back to what you were discussing earlier, what can we do to help change or educate the minds of those people who are more judgmental and unaware of the circumstances and the complexity behind these things?
Well, I think it's very important because somebody has to talk to those people who are so disconnected from that they're willing to accept these policies that don't work and not even willing to listen to people who know better. They're just so closed off. So we need people who, like yourself, can say, hear this other side of the story. Hear these stories. Hear what these kids are talking about. You know, one thing I learned about, again, my friend Michael Mead, was respect means to see again. And I think that's very powerful. You know, the Latin root of it is to see again. Let's see these kids again. Because, you know, you look at them at first, they're hardcore. They got all that, you know, they're cholos, whatever, they pelones. You don't want nothing to do with them. Well, see them again. You're going to realize they're more frightened, more confused than they make out. Then you can see them as somebody you can work with. You can open up something with them. And opening up to me is important because one of the things I do with a gang and a wrench, I like to work with those kids who are older, like late teens, early 20s. One of the reasons why, because that is the big threshold time. You know what I'm talking about? Doors open up amazingly then for everybody. It's the time before your brain fully gets formed. So there's a lot of malleableness. Mm-hmm. And you'd be surprised how when you were 15, you were game, you were going to kill people, you shot people, and then you're like 21, you're like, you're conflicted. What happened? You start maturing. So that's a good age. Get people to realize that you can still save somebody. You can save them any time. But I mean, you can really help somebody at that period because it's the big threshold time. Whole worlds open up if you can intervene properly. You know, show them other ways, imaginative, creative, artistic, heart, compassion, they can see that these things can work. So I think what you can do is help kind of maybe promote or lobby for that with people who don't understand it.
Yes.
Yes. First of all, I'm happy to hear you say that an atheist can have a spirituality.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could comment on the impact that the military is having on the community and the economic draft and what happens to people when they return.
You know, I will have to say from the experience I had with the Vietnam War, and people, I wrote about this because a lot of people don't write about it. A lot of these guys came back to the barrio who went to war. And the gang violence was already bad. It got worse for several reasons. One, they weren't being helped. Two, some of them came back mentally ill. They needed help. Three, they came back heroin addicts. You know, they came back in all kinds of terrible, frayed ways. But they knew how to kill. You understand how powerful that is? And they knew how to do it right. I remember when I was a kid, now when these guys were coming in, we would be with guns. We thought we were big shot guys. We didn't know how to shoot guns. We didn't know how to use guns. We weren't trained. They would take us to the San Gabriel Mountains to know how to shoot. They were, but again, that's great, but the problem was they were hurting people and teaching us how to shoot. You know what I'm saying? So you train people to be better at these things, but you don't help them become better human beings. You understand what I'm getting at? I'm not saying that's true for everybody. A lot of those guys came back from Vietnam. They're okay. They had family there. But I saw too many of them came back fractured, even more broken than when they came in. And I think what's happening now is you got Iraq, you got Afghanistan. You got to address this. And I think the only way to address it, again, is like you do with gang kids. You open up your heart. You open up a real welcoming, for example, that doesn't happen, that didn't happen in Vietnam, that doesn't always happen now. I don't mean just welcome, you know, make heroes out of them, because you know what? This is a big problem I have when people make heroes out of people. Like, wait a minute. They're human beings put in terrible circumstances. Don't make heroes out of them. Make them more human. You understand? Because heroes tend to distance yourself from your own humanity. You want to be heroic. I was heroic in the barrio. It was completely wrong. You know, I'd be the first one to get a gun. I wanted to be the big hero. I wanted to die in the blaze of glory. It was wrong. And we have to help people get to that. Not just call them heroes and you know, they come into the airports and people clapping. You got to do more than that. You got to really welcome them. You got to open up your heart. open up your brokenness so that they can understand why, who they are and what they are, so that whatever good they learned in there, they can use it to enhance and better our communities instead of, in some cases, hurting their families and communities.
Along the same wavelength of my brother here, one of the things that I've struggled with over time and in my education, I have my bachelor's degree, I'm working on my master's currently, but I still live in Watts in the projects, and I struggle to want to give back, and I know that we've talked about community to an extent, and one of the things that I definitely want to do is, you know, I know that, you know, some of the focus of the literature is on gang members, but for me, in talking about community, I think is a beautiful thing. What can somebody, like, you know, who again, same long lines, but who's in the community, like, you know, but still doesn't understand, like, completely, like, you know, like, I understand what it's like to be from like a low social income sort of family and continue to do so, but I think as far as along the lines after that, like, I really have no idea how to connect with my community. What can I do in order to start giving back now?
Well, I think part of the issue sometimes comes when we disqualify ourselves. You know, we rarefy all this stuff, you know. We think it's, I couldn't possibly understand, or I couldn't possibly connect, or, and again, it's never about, say, gang members listening to you. It's about people respecting. I love the sort of the Michael Mead, to see again. But anybody can do that. That's a great equalizer. You know, I think if people have a pulse, you know, they can pretty much be responsive to folks who have, people on the margins who've had to carry more than everybody else. So it's, but we do this a lot. It's a very human thing. We don't approach stuff because we think we can't, or that we disqualify ourselves because even if we're different, you know, your experience is not my experience. But all we're being asked to is to be reverent and to receive people. And that's a great equalizer because everybody can do that, I think.
Thank you both for being here. I was just wondering your opinion on a national community service, because it seems that both the young people in the gangs and the young people in the more affluent societies are lost, and it would be somehow cohesive if they all came together after high school or at some particular age, when they could serve in a national community service.
Well, I'm all for anything that gets people to do something that's healthy in their community. If that's the way to go, that's fine. I don't really particularly want to endorse any program, because to me what I'm talking about is not programmatic. But if that somebody comes up with something and there's a way for somebody to really benefit from it, here's the sad thing. We got a lot of people who don't got jobs, who aren't going to get jobs. Those industries are not going to come back. You understand what I'm getting at? I don't care what Mitt Romney says or anybody, even Obama says, it's not going to happen. So why do we reimagine something different? Why don't we think about what can we happen to reimagine how people can feel fruitful in the sense of, I'm not just working, but I'm also expanding things, I'm multiplying, I'm making seeds grow, you know what I mean, where you're fruitful. The fruitful job is missing in our culture. Now we got people working for nothing. And even people going to college who have 60,000 debts that they're still got to work for, crazy. So it's like, it's not helpful what we're talking about. We're talking about having somebody do something fruitful. If a community's national service does that, and you feel like I'm actually contributing and I'm something's growing out of what I'm doing, then that's good. That's what we need to imagine, other ways for people to contribute without being stuck in the old idea about I need a job the old way. You know what I'm saying? How fruitful can you be in the time that you have in this world?
Hi, thank you for coming tonight. I'm a teacher in the LA Unified School District, and I've noticed that you've spoken basically three major words: power, identity, and hope. How can the schools and education implement programs that could help and those kids in these neighborhoods? How can we do that? How are we able to do that? And is there programs out there that are doing that? Thank you.
Well,
you go ahead.
Oh, boy, don't get me started on the school. But, you know, I wrote something for the Journal of English because they wanted me to talk about how would I handle a classroom. I'm not a teacher, but I love teachers. I mean, teachers are, like, important people, so vital, and yet they're not given nowhere near support that they should get. My wife was a teacher for 10 years, and my daughter's a teacher, so teacher is around me. But here's what I told them. I think you have to recognize there's two spirits, again, in the classroom, if you're going to say what it is. There's that spirit of learning. I don't care who it is, all kids have it. Even the craziest, you know, vato in the street has it, you know. But most schools don't seem to understand it, don't seem to connect to it. And then there's a spirit of teaching. There's this teachers love teaching. Now, when you lose that, then you've lost a lot. And a lot, unfortunately, a lot of the schools take that away from the teachers. There's no more spirit for teaching anymore. Just like the kids, the spirit of learning is gone. We have to get back to where those spirits are working in the classroom again. The combination of both of these, you know what I'm saying? Where the kid wants to learn, the teacher wants to teach. And then you have it come together. Here's what happens when you build curriculums that don't connect that. Or you have testing is the only way to get through this. Or you have a standardized program where everybody's going to be standardized as if there's such a thing as a standard kid. You know what I'm saying? That destroys the spirit of teaching. That destroys the spirit of learning. Let's get back to the origins of what that is.
I've read both of your books. Luis, you actually signed mine for, at the HHS for me. Very good books. Father Greg, you're a very funny guy. you were talking about a voice and being the voice, and the HHS is the gives the kids a microphone. My daughter was actually on the microphone at open mic a couple months ago. Oh, okay. But I wanted to ask you what you think about what's going on in Tucson.
And, oh, good.
And, I mean, you're you've been on the banned books list.
Yeah,
itself,
yeah.
And now your books, I mean, I work at the library. They get checked out like crazy. Yeah. I want to know what you think about what's going on in Tucson and the ethics.
Well, one thing is the Huffington Post is going to have a piece that I wrote. It'll be out by tomorrow. You should look me up on the Latino Voices. And the main thing I'm saying is when you outlaw the truth, you know, it affects everybody. Chicano studies in Tucson is a part of the truth that doesn't get heard. They're not lying. They're not making things up. They have to, like anybody, be factual, have a historical record behind them. You know, they have to do the work. These are academics. They're amazing books. The literary books that are there existing for Chicano studies is vast now. When I was growing up, there was nothing, zero. You couldn't find a book about Chicanos. Now you have hundreds of them. Now we have them, and then in Tucson, you know what they're doing? They're gathering them up. They're taking them out of the hands of the kids. Kids are walking into their classes. Chicano studies is gone. Turn over your books. They're doing it in front of the kids because it's a punishment. They're getting the books so all the kids can watch, and they're storing them away because we're telling them we don't want you reading these books. My books is one of those included. His is going to be one of them because if it was in the curriculum, it would be gone too. Howard Zinn is on that list. All the Native American writers we know is on that list. What is the we have to fight to stop Tucson because it's going to affect everybody. If they stop banning the truth, they're going to ban everything. And that's what we have to fight for, the truth. You know, the guys that are leading it are part of the Tea Party. You know, I don't know if you know that part in Tucson. But I told them, listen, in a good classroom, the Tea Party's views would be heard. I'm not against the Tea Party's views being heard. I'm not against them having a say. But you got to have all these people heard. You got to have Malcolm X. You got to have Che Guevara. You got to have Father Greg. And I'm not saying they're all the same, but you got to have them all there. You know, in other words, you got to have all these voices. They're all important. Let a kid think by having as much knowledge as possible. Span their base of knowledge. So therefore, they won't be governed by a little bit of knowledge.
Hi, thank you for everything. I just had a quick question. I actually haven't read the book, but I was curious as to when you made that decision to get yourself out of the situation in the gang-related area and how you, what kept you going when things got kind of tough or when other people in the membership, maybe they were trying to pull you in. I'm not sure how that works, but...
Well, thank you. I was fortunate, and I tell Father Greg now, but I've been very blessed. Because I was in the barrio, I was in some of the worst things, but I pretty much, I don't know how to explain it, it seemed to think that I was floating in and around it. I wanted to get killed, and I wasn't getting killed. I've been shot at more than half a dozen times and never got hit. I used to stand in the street corners, come get me, man. I wanted to, and it wasn't happening. I lost 25 friends by the time I was 18 because they were dying. I was on heroin. I OD'd 3 times on heroin, and I kept coming back. I don't know why I kept surviving. I didn't want to survive, and yet I was. And I knew people who wanted to survive, and they didn't. Those are things that I can't explain. They're mysteries. But the one thing that I do know is I'm very fortunate, and two, every day I have to make that decision. I'm going to stay sober and clean and peaceful today. It's a decision I have to make every day because my natural tendency is not to be those things. You know what I'm saying? My natural tendency is to be crazy, rageful, and addictive. I have to choose every day to go there. It's a battle. That's why it calls you back. The rages call you back. The addictions call me back. I gave up all the heavy drugs and drank thinking, no big deal, but he drank. I drank for 20 years on top of the 7 years of drug use. That was bad. You see what I'm saying? And so after a while, you realize, and then with my kids, I love my kids. I held them. I abandoned him 2.5 years later. What's up with all that? This is part of the battle to being human in this world. And it's one that you want to give to young kids now, even the ones in the gangs. I don't say, hey, you're going to get out of gangs. Everything's rosy. That's not the way it is. He knows that. But you got to be prepared and strong for the real battles that are worth fighting for. Your life, your kids' lives, your families, your community. You know what I'm saying? I want these people not to find that comfort zone. I want them to become comfortable their whole life. But I want them to be in that place where the uncomfortableness leads to something beautiful, good, and enhancing, not destruction, pain, and the same old hole. So again, it's a decision I have to make every day. The gang calls me back. The body calls me back. The drugs calls me back. Every day it happens. And every day I got to make that choice. Today I'm not going to be called back.
One last question.
I work with at-risk children and adolescents, and I really wish all of my colleagues could be here tonight as well, because I think this gives us a lot of strength and hope. And I first learned about your work 5 years ago, I think, when Bruce Springsteen spoke of his admiration for you in an interview. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious, as much as you feel comfortable talking about that connection and how it's factored into your work for social justice and peace. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We want to end with Bruce Springsteen? I guess so. But let me just say, I guess it's related to all this. Here's what happens. This is, I truly believe this, and I try to get young people to believe it. You change your path. It's always conflictual, but it's going to be a healthy path. I don't know how else to express it, but angels do come out of the woodwork. You know what I'm saying? If it may not seem like it, and maybe at first it doesn't seem like it, but if you stay on that path as much as you can, people will come to support you. I'm totally amazed at the people that have come to support the work that I've done when I didn't have no money, no support, but people did. Father Greg was one of those. He was one of the angels that came out many years ago to Chicago to talk to my kids. I tell people that I couldn't have any white people talk to my kids except for 3 Irish guys. Father Greg, Michael Mead, and Tom Hayden. They're the only ones that would come and talk to my kids. You know, but I mean, and they've all become angels in many ways. And they're not angels because they give me money, though Bruce Springsteen does give me support. They're angels because they saw what I was doing. They connected to it, and they says, I want to be a part of this. Does Bruce Springsteen need that? He don't need me. He don't need nothing. That he does it says something about him. The power that he has for trying to connect to something meaningful. I am amazed that he would even give me the time of day. But there's people like that. John Densmore of the Doors is another good friend of mine. He's a good friend of his. There's people like that. I go, where do these people come from? These are famous people. They don't need to do this. Teach Marine has come and supported us. Why would they give us the time of day? But I think the main thing is that I don't go for that. I'm not doing it for that reason. I do what I do. And hopefully there's enough good-hearted, and there are good-hearted people everywhere, who will look and see, you know what, this is worth something. This is worth, you know, being part of. Now in this time of limits, I want people to realize there's a part of us that's inexhaustibly imaginative and limitless. You understand? There's a part of us that can keep going. It's that creative reservoir of whatever you think we got it from, whether you think it was Buddha or Muhammad or God or Jesus or wherever. We have it. And that part of us allows us to reseed and renew the world every day. New, every time. We have to learn how to be regenerative and doing that every day. And if I'm going to tell kids, you're going to live a different life than the life you've been living, I got to be an example of having lived a life, and every day I got to renew it. So this is what I do, so that somebody like Bruce Springsteen, for whatever he needs to renew his life, can look at it and say, I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of what Bruce Springsteen is about, but he wants to be a part of what I'm about. And that's how we start connecting with everybody. That, to me, is what's important now, that we find these interactive integralness that we all have as human beings. And I have to end with the Mayan saying, in Lakesh, because in Lakesh, to me, says it all. The Mayans have this beautiful saying, and it means, you are the other me. Can we remember that? You are the other me. I am the other you. Those gang kids, as much as we might hate them, scare of them, they're the other you, a part of you that maybe you didn't know you had. And they could use that part of you that can be helpful and healthy and strong, so that they can see there's real human beings, caring, compassionate, authentic people out there in the world. So thank you all for being here. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.